Well, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I think it's pretty amazing that on this glorious day that you are indoors.
Yes, we do too.
I'm delighted to be here this afternoon, this whole week, actually. My name is Anna Marie Vegan, and I'm looking forward to talking this week with you and others about U.S. and international healthcare and health issues. Now, I'm an ethicist, and sometimes people think that that means you talk only about what's wrong with the world. And we are going to be looking at some pretty harsh facts. Today is kind of a bit of smelling salts on U.S. healthcare, and maybe you already know all this because you've lived it. And so, in addition to sharing a few important facts, we want to share stories about this and talk about what these facts mean in the lives of real people. And in fact, whenever I do work in ethics, I try to hold together numbers and people. If we only quote numbers, your eyes glaze over, right? And if we only talk about people, sometimes we don't have a sense of the bigger picture. So when I was researching my book, I came across, I was reading personal journals kept by Audre Lorde, a feminist essayist, poet, professor, who had breast cancer at the time, and she kept journals while she was getting cancer treatment. And in those journals she wrote, "We must learn to count with particular attention." We must learn to count the living with the same particular attention with which we number the dead. We're very good at tallying up statistics, but we're not always good at translating that and keeping that grounded in what that means for human beings. So numbers and people. Today is an overview into U.S. healthcare disparities. And then other topics will emerge later this week. The other piece I wanted to say about ethics is that, okay, sometimes I do complain, sometimes I do talk about what's wrong with the world, but I am not of the opinion that ethics is only critique. If you're going to do ethics, which is the vocation of all of us, I'm not the only ethicist in the room, right? Everybody makes daily decisions that have ethical significance about what you're going to do or not do. How are you going to treat people? How are you going to spend your money? What kind of car you're going to drive? What kind of food you're going to eat? All of these things have ethical significance. If you do ethics well, not only do you have to look at the depth of the issues and complexities and problems, but you have to be constructive. And I tell my students this all the time, who want to be cynical and complacent, that they are not allowed to be cynical until they are at least 75. If I'm not cynical yet, they do not have yet permission to do so. And so I want you to know that we'll try to weave some constructive insights throughout the sessions, but especially in the last session on Friday, we're really going to think about what people of faith can do and how we can be a part of public healthcare dialogues. But that'll come up earlier as well. If you have questions or comments, feel free to raise your hand whenever. Depending on what I'm doing, I might want to hold it and come back to it. I'll write it here on the board, or we might just take it right then, okay? So, first of all, beyond this introduction, I want you to know just this tiny bit more about me and my field of ethics. Chris, if you could show that slide. I'm a weird bioethicist. Most of my colleagues will talk about ethics in terms of stem cell research, cloning, end-of-life care, abortion, simply in terms of should we or shouldn't we? Should we pull the plug? Shouldn't we? Come on in, please, come on in. There's plenty of seats up front, right? Well, you could, but there are plenty of seats up front.
There's some over back here, too.
Yeah, there are some, too. All right, bioethics oftentimes acts as if you can make any of these decisions about what technologies to use or not, when to save life or not, as if they were a moral vacuum, as if you simply applied the principle of beneficence, justice. And I don't agree with that. I think we always need to look at the context, socioeconomics, race, class, gender. So that's the first thing I do that a few others do, but not a lot, not many yet. Also, I'm a white person, I'm Lutheran, growing up in the Midwest, and I really think that we haven't fully addressed racism. Even if Obama is a viable presidential candidate, But there are still more layers of that, and we're going to talk a lot about that tomorrow, but other days as well. Come on in. And then I'm kind of weird, because a lot of times in my field, you either do theological ethics or secular ethics, but not both, and you certainly don't go and talk to people. You read books, for God's sake. You do research, you do studies, you gather the statistics, but you don't ask people to tell their stories. And I have done that in my book, and I'm hoping to do that in another research project in which I combine insights from everyday lives and focus groups and individual stories along with, again, that big picture. And then I'm bold to say that bioethics, even though it has a lot to do with science and technology and medical data, that we who are people of faith can still contribute a theological lens. Now, that doesn't mean we can own the debate or take it over or make everybody agree with us. For example, if we were all going to live by the rules of Jehovah Witnesses, then no one would get a blood transfusion, right? Because that's against that religion. Now, I don't think that we can call all the shots out of our faith tradition, or should, that that's even a goal. But I do think that we can speak with authenticity from our faith traditions and ask others to do the same, and that that can enrich the moral vocabulary, the moral vision of the work that we're doing. And there you have it, that there is a place for theological imagination in bioethics, even in a democratic state, separation of church and state kind of society. So that's a bit about me, and I teach at Loyola University, and I hope that that's enough of an introduction. Today, let's look at some hard facts around U.S. healthcare realities. Maybe you know all this, but just in case, let's have a pop quiz. Okay, number of uninsured in the United States.
47 million,
very well done. Thank you very much. Oh, and I should ask you at first, how many, well, that's a good question, but how many million people live in this country, legally, because the Census Bureau only counts legal inhabitants? 304 million. You can go to the census clock each day and it changes, but we'll call it 304 million. So, to answer your question, what percentage does that mean? 16% for you who are mathematically inclined. I not being one of them. Now, does that sound like a lot, 16 million out of 300? Maybe we can live with that. Not such a huge number. Chris, show them out. Next slide. Okay, we went through that. That equals actually more than the population of 24 states in the District of Columbia. Now, obviously, not everyone in South Dakota, North Dakota, Nebraska are uninsured, but in other words, these numbers equal that many people. We can say other rural states. Hey, I'm from a rural state. Half of our states, in other words. If you think of it that way. All right. Now, what state has the lowest rate of uninsurance or percentage?
Lowest uninsured?
Yeah. Most people are uninsured, in other words. So, lowest.
Most people are
insured.
Most people are insured.
So the lowest uninsured rate.
Minnesota.
Minnesota! We can feel proud, those of us who have lived in that state. 8%, 8.5%. What state has the highest percentage of uninsured people?
Texas.
1 in 4 people in Texas is uninsured. 25%. Thank you, Governor Bush, perhaps.
Yes.
That's right. Amen to that.
All right. Now, we've got 47 million uninsured, no insurance whatsoever for the entire year. What number, who is not counted in that number?
Underinsured.
The underinsured have maybe some insurance, but they don't really use it because it's too expensive, the deductibles are too high, or it doesn't cover what they really need it to cover. Outlaw sister, I call her that because Allison and I can't be legally married unless we go to California, so I call her my outlaw sister. She came back from Japan, had cervical cancer, was treated, and then, but she was teaching English in Japan, and she was covered through Japanese insurance. She came back to the States to teach ESL. No insurance company would cover her cancer risk. They cover all kinds of other things, but nothing related to cancer. A lot of good that does. So how many underinsured are there? People who have some insurance, but it doesn't really cover what they need? Probably around 16 million, but it could be higher.
These folks go without needed medical care. They delay seeking care until they really can't wait any longer. They delay tests, treatments, follow-up. They might have the surgery, but then never see anybody after that, etc. And they, along with some people who do have insurance, are at a great risk for having one significant medical illness take them into bankruptcy. Now, that's some of the facts. Next is the question of how much do we pay for all this health care? All right, how much does the United States spend annually on health care as of 2005? Any guesses?
More per capita than anybody else.
Well, total amount is $2 trillion, over $2 trillion, for 1 year, okay? Now, that means it's 16% of the gross domestic product, because I knew you were going to ask. And it also means, just as you said, sir, it's highest per capita of any country in the world, and that's at $6,700 per person. So we have the highest cost in the world, and our costs are growing on average 2% faster than our gross domestic product. What are other industrialized countries spending? Well, in Luxembourg, it's 5,300. In France, it's 3,200. Germany, 3,200. England, 2,600. Canada, 3,100. Now, you would say, and some people do, because come on in, I often hear this, but we have the best health care in the world. You can get an MRI or a CAT scan at the drop of a hat. You can see specialists, follow-up. You've got genetic technicians and experts wherever you want to go. You know, you have to wait forever in Canada. Well, in Canada, as in the UK, as in France, as in Japan, as in Norway, as in Germany, they're living longer on average than US citizens. Maybe it's because we eat a lot of fast food and don't exercise a whole lot. That can be part of it. But also, there's something about the access and quality issues that mean that in pockets of the United States, we have amazing care. Mayo Clinic, right? For those of you who've been there. But there's so many. We won't go through them all. So we do have wonderful, compassionate, amazingly skilled individuals, and I do not want to be interpreted as discounting that. I mean, my mother is a nurse of 50 years, so I get that we have amazing healthcare services and providers. But even in the midst of that, we have all kinds of people, forget about the MRI, they can't get a cervical screening or a prostate exam or a mammogram. They don't get prenatal care or counseling. Huge variances and differences. So, and also, we have a higher infant mortality rate than Cuba. We have more problems related to preventable deaths. We're not doing as well as other countries in terms of preventable deaths. So I wanted to say something else about that. Oh, in our systems, or you could say inefficient combination of systems, we have among the highest administrative costs that eat up a lot of the healthcare dollar. We're at about almost 8% is spent on just administrative costs, whereas in Germany and Switzerland, they spend 5% on administrative costs. And if we could somehow get that number down, we would save about $50 billion a year. So, are we the best in certain areas? Perhaps. But that doesn't help a whole lot of people who never get in the door. Or if they do get in the door, aren't always treated with a lot of respect. And we'll talk again about more of those kinds of issues tomorrow, for those of you who can make it. All right, so the quiz is done. Now,
in all
yes,
those
sir?
Statistics, does that include undocumented?
No, it does not.
I didn't think so.
Yes, that's really important. They don't officially count.
They don't exist.
We have probably around 14 million undocumented people. But census does not count them in these numbers. And they for sure don't want to be counted, right? So we're talking about legal U.S. residents. Either they are here with visas or they are U.S. citizens. So these are conservative numbers, for sure. The question, do undocumented people have a right to any of our health care, is a whole other question, and we can certainly entertain it, but not yet. Yes, ma'am?
But we do keep statistics on undocumented citizens. I mean, we do in Harris County in Texas, which is Houston's greater area. We keep it because
in terms of health care?
Yeah. Because that's how we actually waive off our professional fees. So we keep very, very careful statistics on what we administer to undocumented folks.
So you work for a hospital? So you'll say this person on a form does not have documentation.
Well, we do it for two things. So for one, in Texas, we have our own SCHIP program, which we provide prenatal care and care to children through. And so by law, we have to assign a number, and it's not always a Social Security number. And so that number, if it doesn't link to a Social Security number,
put in that
we keep it within our database so we know. But then we also keep very, very careful statistics, especially through our county, Harris County hospitals, as to the number of undocumented people we see, because it has to do with how we ultimately...
And the Census Bureau, in all honesty, does have an estimate of undocumented persons based on some of this data, but it hasn't all been merged. When they do their annual report on poverty and insurance statistics, there it's not being folded in there.
And we do keep it in the U.S. natality data set. So on the U.S. natality data set, we do know, because a child is automatically assigned a Social Security number, we do know whether they were delivered to somebody with a Social Security
with or without. Yeah. And that kind of stuff is more and more important when we thought, because this is another area that I work in, is immigration and such, thinking about then how those numbers can be used to then identify folks who don't have them and then have them removed and expedited. So a lot of concern.
Although we're by law not allowed to ever release any of those numbers to immigration officials. So if we have a Social Security number assigned to a child at the time of delivery, we by law are not allowed to release that they don't have a linked Social Security number to a parent.
That's an important issue to stay on top of and see if any efforts are made to change that.
And there haven't been.
Yeah, okay, great. Thanks a lot. We appreciate that information and qualification. In terms of the uninsured, what images come to mind? Who are the uninsured? What assumptions do you make about these 47 million people?
Poor, unemployed,
maybe undocumented.
Working poor.
Are they people who just don't want to buy health insurance?
No.
Well, a lot of people hold the myths that they are without jobs, that they don't work, that they are officially poor, and that, on the other hand, there are the segment of rich people that just could afford it but don't want to. Those are common myths, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, which put out a study on those myths and then contrasted them with the facts. And I'm going to pass a few copies around. But in brief, here's a couple of facts to counter those myths if you ever hear them from others. 8 out of 10 uninsured Americans are from a working family, and 2/3 are low income but not officially poor. Poor is, by the U.S. government standards, you have to meet very specific financial criteria. And so they are not making a ton of money, but they are not officially poor. 79% are American citizens. And over 1/3 of them postpone or neglect medical care needs. And when they do go for care, they are billed and they pay out of pocket. Because another assumption is they just get free care. They can still get care. They go in, they get free care. A lot of them, even if they don't pay all of their bill, are paying some of it. And they are charged at higher rates than those of us who have group plans, because we get a deal through our insurance companies. So they are billed more for that pregnancy and birth or labor and birth than I was. Are you disagreeing with me, or are you upset?
By law, we can't do that anymore. In almost every place, we have really strict controls. So for us...
In Texas.
And actually in other states that practice as well. Because for two reasons. For example, for pregnancy, we have what are called global fees, which means we charge X amount for pregnancy, no matter how many times they're seen. We can upbill on certain things because we can unbundle our ultrasound costs and stuff. But by law, we are allowed to charge certain global packages, and we cannot.
No matter what the insurance.
If they're private pay patients, we can never charge more than 15% discrepancy between what we're reimbursed at our Medicaid rate and what we're allowed to charge for a private payer. And in many situations.
And for uninsured people.
For uninsured people, we cannot charge more than 15% fee. And in many situations, lots of us will actually give them a discount because we would rather them pay up front because
and
we
pay something.
Better pay on the dollar for somebody walking in the door, because I don't have to do a second billing out through another insurance company. So most of us will give discounts. And I know Yale did that for a long time. We give discounts if somebody pays out of pocket.
That I've heard as well.
Yeah.
But it's not, all, I mean, as far as I understand, and maybe things are changing faster than I realize, that's not uniform across the board. In Chicago, at least the people that I've spoken to who have been uninsured has said that they paid or were billed certain.
But by law, we're not allowed to do that. Yeah. We can't do that.
And that's federal law?
It's federal law.
Yeah. And even when you try and make a discount package, you can't discount it very much. Like if you want to try and serve an underserved population, that's considered insurance fraud.
Yeah.
To offer a service at a discounted rate.
You have to bill them the going Medicaid rate, and that's negotiated by state. But we have to bill them that
whatever
rate.
That rate is.
Now, what they choose to pay out and how we adjust the sliding fee scale, something different. But then we docket that back off and say, this is the amount we gave in quote-unquote charity care.
And maybe some of the things that I'm hearing also from people are the assumptions that I'm paying more to.
Exactly.
And the lack of trust with that. Exactly. Since it is a lot of different players and a lot of different payers, it's hard to see the whole chart. It's not like going to a restaurant and everybody gets the same, it's not handed out to you in the same
right.
way. But,
is that related to that? Is that on my recent last month insurance bill, hospital bill, everything else bill, the discount, it's right there in the categories. This is what your treatment was. This is what the total bill is. This is the adjusted rate. Is that what that is? The adjusted
no.
rate is a deal from this insurance.
So the adjusted rate has to do because there's three components that go into any bill. There's a hospital fee, a technical fee, and a professional fee. Okay. So the hospital or the medical center, whatever, reimburses so much. Okay. And then there's a technical fee, which has to do with the person that starts the IV or the person that runs the CT scan. And then there's a professional fee for whoever read it, did it, all of those
things. Well, this says adjusted.
So your adjusted fee has to do with if your insurance company carries a contract with the physician that read your CT scan, you get an adjusted fee because we say that, our contract, we take this amount off for that and the other.
Well, isn't that the problem? Isn't that whole other people are charged more or less depending on if you're insured or not? That's my assumption when I look at that
bill.
No,
because we can't. We're not allowed more than 15% discrepancy.
But that 15%,
that might that might seem like a lot to some people.
Yeah,
it may not in the overall picture, but it may to individual families or persons feel like a big difference. And why is this been worked out?
Different.
But this illustrates a good point, which is that we don't have the most simple health care. Any of us who have gone through...
Why is our admin cost so high?
Any of us who have gone through phone trees or read our bills and statements, those of us, like myself, who have an education, it can be kind of taxing to try to figure out how all these things relate. And have I paid this or not, or what is this for? And how do these bills get arrived at? All right, so I'm just going to move on quickly because we've had some good time on this, but now... it is not 20 to 5. It is. All right. Here are some statistics on the myths and also what we're spending. So these are just for you to take a look at and pass around. I'm doing this instead of, I can't show you websites here, otherwise I would display other websites, but I will hand out at the end of the session of resources on further reading. But you can note where these things come from and you can download them for free on the web. The last thing that I wanted to just mention today, because we're going to talk more about it tomorrow, is in terms of insurance and poverty. Now, as of 2006 data in the Census Bureau, 25% of all U.S. households with an income of $25,000 or less had no health insurance. And to be counted as officially poor, the limits that you could meet in 2006 is this. If you are a family of two adults and two children under the age of 18, then you could earn no more than $20,444 for the year to be considered officially poor by federal standards. States, again, do different margins, and they may have a more gracious number set. If you're single, by the way, a single adult, you could earn no more than $10,488 to be considered officially poor. Now, so that's the beginning benchmark. And those numbers are important, as well as the variations that individual states might make, because they are the key to subsidized insurance or public insurance, Medicaid. If you don't meet certain criteria on that, then unless hospitals have different standards that they set, or there's some combination of charity care at work, then you don't oftentimes qualify for the kinds of health care aid that you might want and need.
So those are some statistics that I wanted to at least start off with. But again, if we stay here too long, we're going to just think about numbers, and we need to keep that in dialogue with the people. So I want to tell you a story about Linda Miller. Linda Miller is a Chicagoan who always had health insurance up until 2000, when Ameritech laid off its employees. For as long as she could, she paid her coverage using COBRA, the federal law that enables former employees to retain coverage that was what they had through their employer for 18 to 36 months. But they have to pay the entire premium themselves. So you're eligible to keep the coverage as long as you can pay for it, and for a limited amount of time. But during that time, she discovered she had breast cancer. Unfortunately, right after she had to end that because she couldn't pay for the COBRA, then she found out she had breast cancer. She was working but uninsured, and now she had the label pre-existing condition. When she found permanent employment, the company's plan refused to cover her cancer care. And this is now Linda speaking about her situation. I couldn't get public assistance because you have to have a serious illness and be unemployed. You see, I'd had temp jobs, and the fact that I worked was held against me. But if I don't work, then how do I take care of myself? I have a new job, but its insurance won't cover my cancer. Bill collectors call, I have no idea how I can pay them, and I think of all those years when I was healthy and I paid for insurance and I didn't even go to the doctor. Now that I need some help, I can't seem to get it. Has anyone in this room been under or uninsured? Have you gone through this yourself? I did for a very brief time during grad school, and wouldn't you know, I broke my wrist during that time too. Since we have this number of people, and I want everybody's voice to be heard, even if not by the entire group, maybe we could just take 5 minutes and talk to another person, maybe someone you don't already know very well, and just talk about, have you had really great experiences with healthcare? Have they been mixed? Have you had trouble getting a second opinion or accessing care? Or just what is your personal encounter with the U.S. healthcare system and systems? So let's just take a couple of minutes so that you can share your story and make sure that each person gets to talk a little bit. Move around if you like.
Thank you. feels like a completely different. I mean, the Canadian. Fundamentally, for me, what comes out is not, it's trying to understand even what you have or what you don't have, even when you think you have something.
Meaning coverage?
Okay. Well, you have coverage. You know, like we were talking, well, I think if you transfer from job to job and there's no break, you get that. But it's like, you know, every all kinds of people fall in holes all over the place because it's so unclear as to where
some people get to take their insurance with them when they're switched off, other people do not, and then feel stuck because of pre-existing conditions. That does happen. Some people like me who teach for a Jesuit university have really great health care. I paid very little for the birth of my son and have excellent nursing care, and I'm very grateful for it, and medical care. Others don't have that. So there is wide variation. Anyone else want to share something? Yes, ma'am.
Yes, when you get older and you're on Medicare, I have not been able to find an insurance company that will give supplemental insurance that will cover anything that Medicare doesn't. In other words, if Medicare doesn't cover it, the other insurance company won't either.
But some people do buy those little extra plans to tack on to Medicare for some of those loopholes. You aren't able to get that yourself?
No.
How is Medicare Plan B working for people, prescription drug coverage, who are using that?
It's terrible.
Not a lot of fun? Or sir, did you have something you wanted to say?
I thought it should be that's D, right?
That's D.
Yeah, I have not slept enough. Sorry, I meant D.
Plan B is emergency contraception.
Yeah, it sure is. That's another topic, other class. I'm still, yes, sir. Christian?
Me?
Yes.
A theme that came up with a number of our stories was the way in which access to better healthcare often comes through knowing somebody or advocacy or these kinds of things that make really clear the differential between levels of healthcare. So if you know somebody or you have an in, then you maybe get a higher level of care than if you don't.
Personal attention and such. That is going to come up very much as an issue tomorrow. And what that is, not only about racial issues, but social location is the larger concept that I want to really talk about. Not so that we feel guilty for those of us who do have connections or do have a lot of individual resources to draw upon, but just so that we're aware of how those things play out differently for different people. What we have seen today in terms of the complexity and what we're about to see in this video, those kinds of dynamics are just intensified when you are a person of color in this country. So that's what we'll pick up tomorrow. For now, let's take a look at some charity care here in the United States. And this was just on this spring, on 60 Minutes. Is there a way to dim the lights here on this wall?
The switches are back by the door there.
So to be continued after school.
Likely to be health care. 47 million Americans have no health insurance, and that's just the start. Millions more are underinsured, unable to pay their deductibles or get access to dental care. Recently, we heard about an American relief organization that airdrops doctors and medicine into the jungles of the Amazon. It's called Remote Area Medical, or RAMP for short. Remote Area Medical sets up emergency clinics where the needs are greatest, but these days, that's not the Amazon. As we first reported in March, this charity, founded to help people who can't reach medical care, finds itself throwing America a lifeline. In a matter of hours, Remote Area Medical set up its massive clinic in an exhibit hall for a weekend in Knoxville, Tennessee. Tools for dentists were laid out by the yard. Optometrists prepared to make hundreds of pairs of glasses. General medical doctors set up for whatever might come through the door. Nearly everything is donated. Everyone is a volunteer. The care is free, but no one could say how many patients might show up. The first clue came a little before midnight when Stan Brock, the founder of Remote Area Medical, opened the gate outside the exhibit hall. The clinic wouldn't open for 7 hours, but people in pain didn't want a chance being left out. State guardsmen came in for crowd control. They handed out what would become precious slips of paper. Numbered tickets to board what amounted to a medical lifeboat.
What about some snacks and blankets?
Well, I hope to stay warm. It's kind of chilly.
It was 27 degrees. The young and the old would spend the night in their cars, running the engine for heat, but not too much, not at $3 a gallon. At 5 a.m., we took a walk through the parking lot.
How long have you been out here tonight?
We got up at 3 o'clock this morning, and we got here about 4. We've been out here for a little while. It's cold.
Why'd you come so early?
Because we wanted to be seen.
Marty Tankersley came with his wife and his daughter, asleep behind the front seats.
You drove 200 miles to get here?
Yes, sir.
And slept in this parking lot for 7 or more hours?
Yes, sir.
Just to have this done?
Yes, sir. I've been in some very excruciating pain.
He had an infected tooth that had been killing him for weeks. Most of the people who filled the lot heard about the clinic on the news or by word of mouth, and they came by the hundreds.
We're very happy that you're here this morning. We've got a lot of really fine volunteer doctors, dentists, eye specialists.
Stan Brock calls Ramp Clinics medical expeditions. He takes all comers, but just for the weekend.
When you set up the first expedition in the United States, were you surprised at the number of people we had?
Yes. Yes, I was. And the numbers are getting higher. And I don't know if it's because we're getting better known or that the healthcare in this country is getting worse. Who's got number one? Come on down. Number one. Number two.
On Saturday at 6 a.m., they entered by the numbers.
Number three.
Inside, 276 volunteers from 11 states were waiting.
Are you here for medical, dental, or vision?
When was the last time you had a breast exam at a nurse or doctor?
For those who were diagnosed with cancer today, or diabetes, or heart disease, Ram will try to find a volunteer doctor who will follow up. Ross Isaacs is one of the doctors.
Who are these patients?
It's the working poor, in the middle of their lives, most with families, most not substance abusers, and employed without adequate insurance.
Dr. Isaac saw Marty Tankersley, the man we met in the parking lot who had driven 200 miles. It turned out that Tankersley, a few years back, had 2 heart attacks and heart surgery, but almost no follow-up since.
So you haven't seen somebody in a while with regards to your ticker and stuff.
The Tankersleys live in Dalton, Georgia. They fall in the category of the underinsured. Marty's a truck driver. He has major medical insurance through his employer, but the deductible is $500, really unaffordable, and the dental insurance costs too much. No one really knows just how many Americans are underinsured, like the Tankersleys.
He's the lucky one that could drive the 200 miles. He's the lucky one that got to see people today and get hooked in. There are tens of hundreds of thousands of people like him.
Marty, his wife and daughter were seen for checkups, glasses, mammograms, and the yanking of that agonizing tooth.
This has truly been a godsend to us, to me and my family, and to all the hundreds of people that's here. I see the faces, the relief in the faces. This has been a wonderful thing.
This was Ram's 524th expedition. Ram took off in 1992, airlifting relief to Latin America. And at age 72, Stan Brock still flies the antique fleet. That C-47 flew on D-Day. Brock is British by birth, an adventurer at heart. He was a cowboy in the Amazon. And then, incredibly, he was discovered by TV's Wild Kingdom. Brock was a star, sort of a naturalist daredevil.
It took only a moment for the situation to totally
reverse itself. Today, Brock is devoted to Ram, completely devoted. He has no family, takes no salary, has no home. Brock lives in an abandoned school that the city of Knoxville leases to Ram for $1. Until recently, he took showers in the courtyard with a hose.
When we see what we've seen over the last weekend, how do you pay for all of that? In the first place, we really know how to stretch the dollar. We operate entirely on the generosity of the American people. I'd like to say that we had big corporate support in America, but we don't. So it's those little checks from those people that send in the $5 and the $10.
Ram operates on a shoestring, about $250,000 a year. And yet last year, it treated 17,000 patients. On this Saturday, there was no sign of a letup.
What have you accomplished today?
Well, we basically had 600 or so people that have arrived here overnight, and we were able to do just about everybody. I think we may have turned away about 15 people who are going to come back tomorrow morning anyway.
The next day, Sunday, there were hundreds more. Tickets started again with the number one, but now the doctors were racing time in hours. They'd be headed home.
Who's got 361? 362? 362? 363?
We're really glad that you came in, especially.
Nurse practitioner Teresa Gardner was worried about Rebecca McWilliams. McWilliams had surgery for cervical cancer in 2005, but without the recommended follow-up.
How long has it been?
It's been about two years since I've had my last pap smear, and I was supposed to have every 6 months, and I've really only had it once since that surgery.
You know, I think many doctors would say you've taken a terrible risk.
Yeah.
Waiting this long.
I really have, but it's just, like I said, it's very hard to afford it. I have three kids, and my husband lost his job this past summer.
McWilliams' pap smear came back clear, but in her exam, Gardner found reason to worry.
I think just from, you know, the clinical inspection of the cervix that, you know, possibly there is a possibility that cancer, you know, still being there.
She's 28 years old.
28 years old, the mother of three.
You've created this medical organization that was designed to go into third world countries, to go into remote places, and now you're doing 60% of your work in urban and rural America. What are we supposed to make of that?
That for 50 million or so people in this country, the one thing that is on their mind is, what if I have a catastrophic event, a car crash, a heart attack?
Because they don't have health insurance.
Because I either have no health insurance or I'm underinsured. And so this is a very, very weighty thing to be thinking about, knowing that your family is in great jeopardy.
376, 377, 378. 379, 380.
Late on Sunday, Joanne Ford's number was among the last to be called. We found her sitting by a stairwell.
And you don't have that?
Well, no, not on a Social Security disability income.
She's retired, living on disability with no insurance, and her glasses don't work anymore. She got in, only to find out that the vision care line had closed.
How is your vision?
I bet in my left eye, probably, I couldn't see your face. The Lord will take care of me. The Lord will provide. The Lord will provide.
But not today.
But not today. Well, I got to look for another option. But I'll find one.
What are you going to do?
I don't know. I have a lot of good friends, and I have a lot of church support. I was very active in my church. I have a lot of friends in church. I just hate to ask. I've worked all my life. I hate to ask. That's why things like this are so wrong.
There is no shame in seeking health care.
No, you're right. You know, it really, I am sad that we are the wealthiest nation in the world and we don't take care of our own. So, but it will be okay.
And it did turn out okay after all. Someone at RAM noticed Joanne's situation. They put her in the vision care line and examined her for a new pair of glasses.
If I may have your attention, please. I'm afraid that we've got some rather disappointing news.
But at the gate, many were waiting when the weekend ended.
449 and 450.
In the expedition to Knoxville, Rand saw 920 patients, made 500 pairs of glasses, did 94 mammograms, extracted 1,066 teeth, and did 567 fillings. But when Stan Brock called the last number, 400 people were turned away.
What's going through your mind when you're reading off the last two or three numbers and you see so many more people at the gate than are going to be able to come in?
Yeah, well, you know, that's the lousy part of this job. I mean, it's nice, you know, to be able to know that you've helped a bunch of people, but the reality is that we can't do everybody. At the moment, we're just doing the thousands and thousands of people that we can, and the rest of them, unfortunately, have got to do the best they can without us.
Since we first broadcast this story in March, Remote Area Medical has received close to $2.5 million in donations. Next weekend, RAM will hold its biggest expedition of the year in Wise County, Virginia.
So we have about 5 minutes if anybody wants to comment. Ask either about this session so far or the video.
Do any leaders see things like this?
Well, I'm pleased that healthcare is much more on the national agenda than it was in 2004. I mean, it was being talked about, but I think that not to the degree and the depth that we are now hearing.
We hear about it, but it's so confusing just to figure out your own bills for your small family. Mm-hmm. You can't tell from the sound bites or the few minutes here or there, or even on a debate. Whose plan is best? Mm-hmm. How do you figure all that out?
Well, that's something for Friday. Yes, sir.
My partner works in healthcare and in the administration side. She's one of the 2 billion, or whatever we could say by cutting her administration costs. But anyway, her observation is that the insurance companies, for example, this new plan. Plan D, is that what it's called?
For prescription drugs?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Her insurance company, which is enormous in the Seattle area, it's Group Health, for those of you who mm-hmm. know it, doesn't know what to make of it either. I mean, the government isn't telling them what all of this means. In fact, mm-hmm. her impression was that most people in government, even when they were voting for it, the folks that voted for it, didn't know exactly what it meant. And so it's up to the insurance company, the folks who are in charge of compliance, to figure out what it means. And so what they're really doing is talking to their lawyers, saying, what can this mean to our best advantage? What can we get away with in order to cut costs as much as possible? So it sounds like it's not just hard for the patient.
No,
it's hard for anybody to figure out what to make of it.
No. And it's a very important point, if I can just extrapolate a bit on that. I really want to emphasize, because there are a lot of problems and a lot of feelings and it's a contentious topic, I don't want this to sound like it's patients versus providers or versus the insurers or versus the folks who are doing the bill keeping and the account keeping. And everybody is in a tough place, I think, by the current realities. And a lot of people feel conflicted about their roles and about their limits. How much can I do? I know great, amazing doctors who are deciding not to practice anymore or changing specializations because of either the personal burdens as well as the financial ones on them. So I don't want this to sound like it's only the plight of the patient. It's everybody is in various complex, difficult situations. However, having said that, I will say that I am really most concerned about, and this is why I'm both a Christian and a social ethicist, about thinking about the lives and the people who are most likely to be ignored or missed. So I do focus on where I think our group attention is not always sharply focused.
And I think that, sorry.
Go ahead.
I think when you said, are leaders listening to this? Leaders will listen to what their constituencies want them to hear, and there is so much diversion out there that it's very important, because all of us have our own stories. We know someone, it's happened to us, something like that. That makes it personal, that we have to keep it on the front burner, not fall into these traps of diversions. You know, they want to talk about things, whether someone's wearing a lapel pin and make that an issue. This is not an issue. These are issues. These are issues for everybody. In my practice as a nurse, I met a woman who had saved her whole life for a house. She fell on her job. She was on disability for a while. Couldn't go back to her work. Lost her house. Lost all the money she'd saved. Couldn't get health care again. I met her in a women's shelter. That's where I met her. These are issues that affect everybody, and it's too important to be distracted by these little issues out there. So if you want your leaders to hear these things, then we're the ones who have to speak with our voices and keep it on the front burner.
Thanks,
Tara.
Yes.
I think too, I mean, just the complexity of it is enormous. And so I'm a provider. And one of the reasons, I'm at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, and one of the reasons many of us are there is because it's one of the few places in the U.S. where we transition between the public and the private sector. Mm-hmm. And so we provide the medical care to the private side of the Texas Medical Center, but we also provide the Harris County Hospital mm-hmm. District or Ventas, which is now the third largest single hospital in the country. And so a lot of us are there because we can actually transition between mm-hmm. the two. And I think a lot of the movements towards providing care for patients has come from a number of different physicians groups, mm-hmm. one of which was actually started in Houston, but now there's the Physicians for Healthcare Plans, and there's very sophisticated advocacy groups that come from physicians. But I think that I mean, even when you deal with this day in and day out, I still don't understand a lot of it, and I even have a major administrative role.
Right.
And it's really, really hard to figure it all out and figure out any given contract with any given insurance company and what you're allowed to do by law. So most states, for example, by law have to provide mammograms and pap smears uh-huh. for women for uh-huh. free.
Right.
If they can't afford to pay them, you have to by law provide them.
Yeah.
But who does it and where you get it is like
where are those clinics located, where are those hot sites in there? How do people get there?
Right. Yep. It's really and I would say that I think that I assume we're going to get into a component of this. From my perspective, and I know there's at least one other obstetrical provider in the audience, you know, a major burden comes from malpractice legislation. And what we choose to do and what we train the next generation of physicians to do is biased by the fact that we get sued, and we get sued all the time.
I know, and then there are people leaving obstetrics, especially
for exactly that reason, because we can't afford it. My malpractice as a self-insured group, and I do high-risk obstetrics, is $240,000 a year. Mm-hmm. That's what I pay mm-hmm. for my malpractice insurance.
The Kaiser,
I have to pay it for a minimum of 20 years, even if I quit today.
Right. The Kaiser Family Foundation has some great statistics, though, on malpractice. And in certain areas, it is exactly. Obstetrics is one of the main huge areas. But in other areas, how much that is blown up and that's used. Well, we just have to focus on malpractice. And it's used, again, as a screen to not address these other systemic issues.
Right.
So, and I'm not at all disagreeing with what you're saying, but I'm saying sometimes we use it again to say, to look at all there, and on in mean people suing, because the wrong kidney was removed or whatever, but, you know, or because they just didn't like their doctor, you know, and we use it then as a way to get out of dealing with some of these other issues that really, really have to be dealt
with. And it's so multifaceted. I mean, even we hire, I mean, I don't know if people know this, but for every physician group, you figure you have to have a biller and a coder for every three physicians. So you have to have two people that do nothing but bill and code for every three providers.
And the thing about it is that people that I've heard and read about in books and interviews that have been done, they think that any change will mean we'll lose the best quality that we have in those areas. And they think that for some reason, it has to be this complicated, but you know, we don't have to have this complicated of a bureaucratic system. Now, I don't want your wife to lose her job. I'm not saying I'm not putting her on the street, but I'm saying that, and we'll talk about this Friday, but people will say it's too complicated or you know, oh, let's go to electronic records. Okay, that's a piece of it, but that's, you know, and some are, and that's great. Maybe Baylor's done a lot with that, but there are a lot of pieces. But then people get uptight, and they go, oh, there are too many pieces, and then they walk away from it. Well, we're Americans, for God's sake. Ingenuity, we put people on the moon. You know, we decoded the DNA. Don't tell me this is too hard. Oh, I can't figure it out. I don't let my students get away with that. Why are we letting our government get away with that? Why are we letting that happen? Back to Tira.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that on Friday. I do have this resource. If I don't, I didn't know how many copies to make. So if you don't get one today, just come by at the end or beginning of the session if you don't want to come to the whole session. I'll give you one. I'll keep making them throughout the week for further reading and research. Thank you for your time today.